values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, appreciate you spending some time with us right now. We still have you giving you an opportunity to register to win the hottest ticket in town. Of course, that's Suns playoff tickets. We are going to be calling out names today during the 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. hours. I'll be doing it in the 11 a.m. hour. If you want to qualify to win these tickets, you just need to call in when your name is called. To get your name on the list, just text the word ticket to 411-923. That's ticket to 411-923. All right, I want to take a, for a moment, I want to talk a little bit about this guy that was arrested. His name is Zion William Teasley. And he was arrested, and there you can see, this is all public record, by the way. You can look this up, which is exactly what I've been doing, trying to find out more about this guy. What we're hearing, and is true, that he went to jail for disorderly conduct. And that's what he pleaded guilty to, is disorderly conduct. He was given time served while he was in jail for that charge. And I think he was released early as well, which is why he got out of jail in November of last year. But originally, he was charged with a count of burglary, armed robbery with a deadly weapon, 4 counts of robbery, 5 counts of kidnapping, 1 count of aggravated assault, a count of disorderly conduct with weapons. He pleads to the disorderly conduct charge and a couple of others, but in the final disposition of the case, it only shows the disorderly conduct charge. So question number one is if this guy did all of those other things. Now, again, maybe there's more to it. Maybe there's a reason why they went in with all these charges. But if you go in with something like 5 counts of kidnapping, how does it only end up with a disorderly conduct charge? These are questions that I'm sure that this poor victim's family is going to ask. This is part of the, when we talk about the justice system and how it's supposed to work, we talk about police officers that make the cases. The Phoenix Police Department, and I'm sure in conjunction with others, the Phoenix Police Department went to work and did their jobs. They found out who this person was, located where this person was, and safely took him into custody. They've done their job. You have prosecutors that charge cases and take them to trial. And then you've got judges. If we don't see the prosecution side of this, along with the judges that are willing to do what's necessary to keep dangerous people off the street, these things happen. What is the mental health of this person? Why did he do this? What, you know, what were the reasons behind him committing this crime? Why her? Was she stalked? What, did he follow her? Did he know her? Did he just come across her on that trail? Was it wrong place, wrong time? All of these things, I imagine, are going to be coming out in the coming days, and we'll learn more about the mental state of this young man. But you have to ask your question, ask the question at least, and I hope some people are going to be asking those questions. If there is someone that was charged with this many crimes when he was originally arrested, how many crimes did he commit? I mean, if you're talking about these counts of robbery and burglary, so if it's 5 counts of kidnapping, is it 5 counts of kidnapping because in one of these armed robberies, did he kidnap 5 people that were in that one place? That's a great question. These 4 counts of robbery, these counts using a deadly weapon. So here we are in this country having this horrible conversation about violent crimes, which I would tell you, I believe is a valid and valuable conversation. But we continue to look at the wrong things. You know, it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, which is why I'm not jumping to conclusions, but I am pointing out facts that need to be investigated. There are valid questions that need to be asked. And if there are valid answers, then great. We'll hear the valid answers and we'll move on. But to the naked eye, anybody out there that – and he's got a unique name. He's got a unique name in Zion Teasley. You can look it up. And he's got a criminal record that is a mile long for his arrest. The final disposition of the case is different. This is where people have to start asking the right questions, in my opinion. We can continue to do things where we blame innocent people for crime, or we can actually go after the criminals and say it won't be tolerated. And again, if you're talking about mental health, if it's someone that has a severe mental health issue, which is possible, if this is something to do with mental health, if you look at the Jared Loughner case, which is a horrible thing that happened. If you remember, Jared Loughner was the young man that shot at former Congresswoman Giffords and murdered a judge and murdered a little girl and other people down in Tucson in that shooting incident. He was deemed that it was deemed that he wasn't able, mentally capable of standing trial. But if you look up to what led to that, there were people that knew that he was severely mentally ill. And I mean severely and dangerously mentally ill. When people were interviewed that knew him, they were terrified that this guy was going to commit that kind of a crime. And so when that happens, why aren't we getting better at that threat assessment? Why aren't we getting better at talking about these issues? Because Jared Loughner wasn't just turned out onto the streets. It looks as if this young man that did this was arrested for multiple violent crimes, ended up pleading guilty to minimal amounts of those crimes, given credit for time served in jail, which maybe, again, it might be something that's standard procedure. But you can't tell me, and I don't know the status yet, but if there's some kind of mental illness connected to this death, that they must have known it in the first case. And why wasn't anything done? What was done, if there was anything? And we need to, as a society, we should be asking these questions. That's my humble opinion. It's easy to Monday morning quarterback, and I'm trying not to be the telling people this is what you should have done. But when this happens, and the family deserves to have answers to these questions, especially the family deserves to have answers to these questions. When you find out about the person that committed the crime, and I'm sure we're going to find out motive if there was one and everything else, why was this person not in prison? Well, those are really good questions. And I just hope this family gets justice, and I hope that they are able to heal as best as you can in a circumstance like this. It is a difficult, difficult place to be in. Coming up in a moment, we are going to talk about the lawyers for former gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake have been fined because of some of the things that they said. What did they say? What will they pay? And what happens next to the challenge to the election? It all comes up in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. It's always a privilege to have you join the show. Interesting story came out. Carrie Lake's attorneys, Carrie Lake, former gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, has been challenging the results of the midterm elections, believing that her race was lost because it was fraudulent. And so she has been challenging this. Most of the charges or the accusations were thrown out, but there is one that still continues through the court. We'll get to that in a moment. And it's a challenge to the way that voter signatures were verified in Maricopa County. She said it was done fraudulently or illegally. They didn't do it. But here's the interesting part of this. Her lawyers were sued, and her so was her campaign, by the governor, Katie Hobbs, and by the Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes. And although the judge declined to force the lawyers to pay her attorneys, the attorney fees of the governor and the Secretary of State, they didn't make the lawyers pay a $2,000 fine to the court clerk for repeatedly claiming it was an undisputed fact that 35,563 ballots were added to the results at the Maricopa County's third-party ballot processor. So even after the Supreme Court itself said Lake did not show evidence to prove ballots were added, her attorneys, Brian Blem and Kurt Olson, made it the claim again in April court filing. Sometimes campaigns and their attendant hyperbole spill over into legal challenges, according to the Supreme Court. But once a contest enters the judicial arena, rules of attorney ethics apply. Those rules build confidence in the judicial system, the court said, noting that the sanctions can deter lawyers from making false statements in the future. So Olson is a Washington, D.C. based attorney. I'm reading this from a news story. And Blem is known for locally for dual work representing Arizona Senate and a hired contractor in the 2020 ballot review. He said, "We respectfully disagree with the court's holding, but look forward to presenting our case at trial." So this is kind of where it stuck. And right now, we know that what's next here is the challenge from the Lake campaign is that the ballots, now the only challenge challenge that still remains, and a judge has got no timeline for looking into it, is whether or not Maricopa County obeyed the law when it processed and it verified early ballot signatures. So on Thursday, the Arizona court directed the issue should be moved forward, and we'll see how quickly this happens. The Superior Court Judge Peter Thompson previously dismissed the argument based on timing, but the Supreme Court said no, that this should be held up. Legal experts have outlined how hard that will be to do, which is they have to, the Supreme Court set a high bar to prove her argument, saying she must show enough votes were affected by what she says were faulty signature verification practices to alter the outcome of the election. That conclusion must come from math. And here's a quote from the court. Not simply an untethered assertion of uncertainty. So they believe that there's a very high bar here. What will happen next? Because I believe this court case is going to continue to its conclusion. We don't know how rapidly. But this is moving, hopefully, one step closer where we're going to be moving toward 2024. We all know that Carrie Lake's name has been... it's been speculated that she may run for the United States Senate. She has also kind of leaned toward that speculation as well, saying she's not sure what she's going to do. But we'll see if she decides she's going to get into that race. What does this say about election integrity now? Because does this mean, and people are entrenched. I'm not talking about the entrenched people. There are people out there that will never, no matter what you say or do, will never ever believe that the election was not stolen. And there are other people over there that will never ever believe ever that there's anything wrong with our election system, that all of this is just a claim of cheating that is unfounded. Those people will never move no matter what evidence is put their way. But what about the people out there? Because there are a lot of people that believe that the elections weren't fair a number of times. I'm not one of them. I don't subscribe to it, but I'm also not emotionally invested in this. And it's an emotional conversation, which is interesting to me, that, you know, I understand the integrity of the vote, and that's why it's emotional. But I mean, toward people that disagree. I was at an event recently and had a conversation with someone. I was speaking to a group, and I wasn't speaking about election integrity. I was speaking to a group. And when I was done speaking, the very first question I took was about election integrity. And I answered the question the best I could. And then one of the people in the room was sitting there. He was a guy sitting there with his arms crossed. And he said, "So do you think the election was stolen?" And I said, "No." And he laughed. He said, "Huh, man, would I like to have a conversation with you?" And I thought, you know, of course you would. And I'd like to have a conversation with you. But the assumption sitting in that chair that you have information that I haven't seen yet, I just disagree. I'm not kicking you in the teeth. I'm not saying you're a horrible human being. I'm saying I disagree with your findings of the same evidence, that I've looked at everything and I don't believe the election is stolen. That's it. I'm not calling you names, and I'm not kicking you in the teeth. And so why are you acting as if I just don't have all the information, that you have the magic piece of evidence that I haven't seen yet that's going to change my mind? And that seems to be the argument that happens, is that people that believe the election is stolen believe they have secret information that nobody else has. And if you just knew what they knew, you would agree with them. And I respectfully disagree in that regard. I think that we have to, and the problem being, it has become such a passion an issue for the people that believe the election was messed with, that you can't deal with each other on any other issue. That's the biggest problem for me, that for some it's still a litmus test. If I said, with all of my qualifications and all of my years of volunteering and all of the things I've done, if I decided, you know what, I'm done with radio, I'm going to run for the legislature, I'm going to run for the city council, I'm going to run for a school board seat. And, well, I guess a school board's not in there because that's not that's a nonpartisan race. But if I was going to run for any kind of a partisan race and I had to go through a primary process, the litmus test would be, in many circles, whether or not I thought the election was stolen. Doesn't matter what my other qualifications are. It doesn't matter what the other good things I have done or could do are. If I go into that room and say I don't believe the election was, even if I didn't have a say in anything moving forward about elections, that's the litmus test. And at some point, it needs to not be the litmus test. We have so many things that are going on in our society that we have got to be a part of fixing. And it's ripe for the taking for people. And yet the litmus test in these rooms, and many of these people are powerful, man. They got votes within the party. They support you. They don't support you. And I just think we are setting ourselves up as not just, this isn't just Republican, Democrat. We as society on this issue are setting ourselves up to live in the past, and it's not boding well for the future. What we're going to do in just a moment is Congressman Ruben Gallego is now speaking out about the president and his plan with 1,500 troops and what he says needs to happen. You'll hear it next.
Values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, we're still giving you an opportunity to score the hottest tickets in town. We have Suns playoff tickets. We are going to be calling a name out in the 11 a.m. hour. Then they'll do it again in the afternoon in the 4 p.m. hour. If you hear your name, you have 10 minutes to call, and you're registered to possibly win those tickets. You want to get on that list? Just text the word ticket to 411-923. That's ticket to 411-923. So here is Ruben Gallego, Arizona Democrat congressman, going to challenge for a Senate seat, is being critical of the Biden administration and what they are doing. I'm going to read a couple of quotes from the congressman. I've heard directly from leaders in our border communities, and it's abundantly clear that they, through no fault of their own, are simply unequipped to handle the surge of migrants that are expected when Title 42 ends. They need tangible resources like buses, beds, personnel, and funds to both process asylum claims in an orderly way and keep their communities safe. It is imperative that the Biden administration work directly in real time with these communities to support them in every way they need. That is an Arizona Democrat saying that. So I want you to hear an NBC News report about El Paso, Texas.
At dawn, the migrants covered in blankets stretch for blocks. And tonight, El Paso is under a state of emergency because city officials say they don't have enough resources to handle this.
Are you desperate?
I'm very desperate. Maria Angel from Venezuela tells us, next to her 10-year-old daughter. I don't have anything to eat. I don't have anywhere to sleep, she says. Today, we saw that desperation as migrants here scramble for food and water.
We were here several months ago, and there appear to be many more migrants now. The difference is striking. This group extends all the way around this church for several city blocks.
The description of the video is one thing, but having seen it is another. The screaming you heard in part of that video was when a box truck showed up with supplies of food and water, and it was almost like an assault on this vehicle and a mad dash to get to this truck. It's dangerous. There is video of people driving down the streets of El Paso with human beings literally covering the sidewalk from edge to edge all the way around buildings. This is a crisis like this country has not seen in a long time. We are focused on the wrong things in this country, and we need to be focused on this. The idea that it's just, it is, because I don't want to convolute, this is a border security issue, and it does encompass human beings and what's going to be done at the expiration of Title 42, but it's also a crime. The crime of the drugs, the fentanyl that's coming in. What is it? Our 279% increase in fentanyl deaths in just the last few years. It is so deep and so disastrous. Yesterday I talked, and we're going to talk next week, at the beginning of next week, with some whistleblowers that have testified before Congress that were working to help migrant children, unaccompanied migrant children, be partnered up with sponsor families. Many times they were immediate family members or extended family members, but in many cases they weren't. What kind of vetting process are we using? There are about 85,000 minors that the federal government cannot account for. I want you to think about that number. We have 85,000 children that have come into this country, and we understand as Americans we have a different standard, and we always should. I'm not complaining about the standard. The standard for us is we care for children. We're not always good at it. You know, our foster program is one that we need to, I would love to see be a better program. But the parents that volunteer in the foster program are good people for the most part. Very, very good people that are dedicated to giving these children that are transitioning sometimes from one situation to another and giving them a stable place to be. Many times it's the closest thing to a family these kids will ever see. But we also understand there's a standard we have in the U.S. for protecting children. We pull children out of the homes here from their parents when parents are abusive. You've got children crossing into our country that have no one. Their parents are sending them with the cartels. They're getting into America and we're putting them with families and they're gone. We don't know where they are. 85,000 unaccompanied minors that they cannot account for. They've disappeared. The questions now are coming up. How are we vetting these sponsor families? Are we doing any kind of a background check? What kind of follow-up is being done to make sure that these children are being treated fairly, that they're not being forced into labor camps or being, you know, abused, forced into slavery? God forbid human trafficking in the sense of sexual trafficking. You understand what I'm talking about. We don't have the answer to that question. And this is just becoming so overwhelmingly bad that at what point do we start really saying, and I keep saying this about the electorate because it's frustrating to me. I'm one voice. I just happen to have a microphone, but I'm also only one vote and I don't have any more power than anybody else when I go to the ballot box. Why are we not talking about solutions? Why are we not as an electorate? I'm not talking about Republicans and I'm not talking about Democrats and I'm not talking about independents. I'm talking about Americans. Why are we not looking? Go online. Everybody has a smartphone. Everybody has a tablet. We all have computers and the internet. Look at those videos from El Paso, Texas, and you tell me that's an acceptable immigration system in our country. Watch the people storm this truck in this dangerous mad dash for food and water. And explain to me that that's acceptable as Americans. Blame who you want to blame. I think everyone's to blame. I think our government has dropped the ball and there is a refusal to work together. You know, Congressman Gallego is a staunch Democrat. And you understand in political parties, when you stand up to your own party, there is a backlash sometimes. But at least the congressman in this case is standing up and saying, hang on, I don't care if it's a Democrat president or a Republican president. I'm representing the people of Arizona, and this is unacceptable. It's interesting. Two people that would be considered politically polar opposites would be Congressman Juan Ciscomani in southern Arizona and Congressman Ruben Gallego from the Phoenix area. On many, 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 many issues, they would find themselves on the opposite side of the debate many times. But when I've read you quotes from Ciscomani and I've read you quotes now from Gallego, they're echoing the same sentiment. So if you've got two members of Congress that battle each other, and I'm not saying they're adversaries all the time, I'm saying political adversaries. I imagine they have a good rapport personally. But political adversaries that are looking at this issue and saying this is one area where we can agree, where does the electorate come in? Where do we, the voters, come in on a situation like this? And we demand that something be done to this White House. We demand that something be done by the Congress, and you force the hand of the president to sign it. At some point, it's our obligation. I mean, don't you think? At some point, it's our obligation to stand up and say enough is enough. If you can watch those videos of El Paso and say it's acceptable, you're a different person than I am. If you can read the story I had yesterday about 85,000 undocumented minors in this country that the government cannot account for and call that acceptable, you're a different person than I am. At what point are we motivated to action? That's my question. In a moment, vaccine mandates. The Biden administration quietly ends vaccine mandates. We'll talk about why that's important. It's coming up in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. This is a local story that affects all of us. I was going to talk about COVID, but COVID is, I'll sum it up for you. The WHO has said it's over. The Biden administration is getting rid of the vaccine mandates, although they're not talking about it. And irony of all ironies, they had a big CDC conference in Atlanta a few weeks ago, and it's the CDC disease sleuths, the people who look for diseases. A bunch of them caught COVID at the conference. Little irony. But let's talk about what I think is more important, and it is this. A bipartisan group of lawmakers are urging support for a trio of bills on housing. Now, what these bills would do is interesting. Senate Bill 1161 would require cities of more than 525,000, which would be currently Phoenix and Tucson, and fairly soon it would be Mesa, to allow low-income rental housing in areas zoned for commercial, multifamily, or mixed use within a half mile of light rail or streetcar stops. Senate Bill 1163 would force cities with populations over 30,000 to allow zoning for duplexes and triples, would restrict their ability to limit total housing units per acre, and would require them to permit smaller lots. And then House Bill 2536 would restrict cities' ability to impose aesthetics and off-street parking requirements, would allow them to allow single-room rentals and accessory dwelling units, would set a time limit for approving zoning applications, and would prohibit cities from adopting more restrictive zoning requirements. I have to tell you that all three of these have value. The ability to build a duplex, to build a triplex or a triple, they call it, to be able to get more people in more quickly, to set a limit on how long your zoning can take. We've talked about this at great length. The added time to a project. I think about people that have some money that would become a part of an investor group that says, hey, let's invest in some land and build an apartment complex. And as a group, we're going to own this apartment complex, and this is going to be a part of our retirement package. So we're all going to put in a bunch of money. We're going to buy this piece of land. We're going to get it rezoned, or we're going to make sure it's zoned for what we want. We're then going to design the building. We're going to take it to the city. We're going to take it to the county. We're going to make sure it's compliant. We're going to build the project. The amount of time it takes for that to happen is pushing a lot of people away from it, because it takes too long. You're going to set your money, and it's going to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. The lawyers and engineering and architects' fees that you have to pay in order to get one of those projects moved through the process, the amount of time it takes when they kick things back. I'll give you a practical on-the-job site application for this. Now, I will tell you, it's interesting, working with the cities, working with, and like I did, as a contractor, in the field, the inspectors in the field were, for the most part, with few exceptions, amazing to work with. They wanted the project to be done right, but they wanted you to be able to proceed. So here's two ways of dealing with a problem. One is you go onto a job site, you're an inspector, and when I worked with them, an inspector would come onto my job site, and the inspector would walk around. He or she would look around to make sure whatever the inspection was, that I was within code. If they found a violation, they would write it down, and then when the inspection was done, they would say to me, all right, here are the areas that you need to fix. And they would point them out and say, this needs to be fixed and this needs to be fixed. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write a note on the plans that says, I told you to fix this. When I come back, I'm going to make sure you fixed it. Don't make me look like an idiot. Fix it, but keep going. You don't have to stop and fix it and have me come back in 2 or 3 days. Fix it and move on. That's one way to handle it. The other way to handle it is to walk in a job site. And this has only happened to me once in 20 years. Walk in a job site, electrical inspector found a problem and said, that needs to be changed. Okay, call me when you fix it. Well, can you do the rest of the inspection? No, I found that problem, fix that problem. So you fix that problem, you call them back, they come back a day or two later, they look, if they find a second problem, they leave after that second problem. It's rare that that happens, but that can dramatically slow down the progress of a job. And mistakes do happen. Even as small as they are, they do happen. So imagine you're going through a process where you're hiring engineers and you're hiring architects and you're taking these plans to the city, and the city has one set of requirements and the county's requirements are different, and one kicks them out, so you got to fix that, then take it back to the other guys because you've made a change. This takes years sometimes. And here we are at a critical time with a housing crunch. The other part of it is, where can you build it? You can't, that's not zoned for that. You can't build it there. No, you can't build that there. This has got to happen here. Or we're going to make you as a city do so many things with aesthetics that it's going to cost you so much more money to build your project. By the time you sell or rent these units, you're charging such a high price because of all the money we as a city have forced you to put into that project. And so this is the legislature trying to say, let's get out of the way of building. Instead of adding more requirements, it's saying, let's take some of this stuff away. Let's limit how long you can take with engineering and design and zoning, and you have to answer these questions in a timely fashion. Even in that case, they're not telling people to change what their rules are. They're saying, you've got to get this done in a more timely fashion. How does anybody think that's a bad idea? So keep your eyes. If you're someone that follows these things, there's three bills in the legislature that may make it easier for some of these projects to get built in other places, and zoning requirements and expedited services. I think it's a great idea, and hopefully it's going to work out that way. Coming up just after 10 o'clock, we're going to talk about the economy, because job growth far exceeded expectations. What will that do to the possibility of a rate increase coming up again? What does this do for inflation? And one of the major shipping companies in the world says they are beginning to see a slowdown. We'll talk about what all of it means next.